content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, my name is Joe Austin, and I'm your host and producer for today's episode of Legal Matters, an original program produced in the Triangle Radio Reading Service studio. For the next half hour, we'll be exploring topics to champion your legal rights to obtain equal access and full participation in your community and to achieve your goals of independent living. Every fourth Tuesday of each month, you can find us here providing news and information from federal and state agencies, as well as nonprofit organizations that promote information on laws supporting independent living. In today's episode, I have the great pleasure to have as my guest Dean Melissa Essery from the Campbell University School of Law. Dean Essery, thank you so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here, Joe. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much, and very excited about this. You know, if I was to read through your biography, it would take a whole half hour about your accomplishments.
But, Much too kind.
Tell us a little bit about yourself and your biography, and if you get too humble, I'll add some details that people need to know about you.
Well, let me start with the fact that I'm from Texas, but I love North Carolina. If I can be forgiven for being from Texas, by loving North Carolina, please do so. I grew up in a very small town in Texas, population 2,500. Went off to the University of Texas at Austin, which was a great metropolis to this small town girl, and got my undergraduate degree in journalism. Took a media law class while I was at UT, and we call University of Texas UT. I know that's Tennessee here, but it's UT in Texas. Media law galvanized my interest in the law, and I ended up at Baylor Law School, where after 3 years' time, I got my degree and then began practicing law.
You've been too humble there. You graduated magna cum laude from the University of Texas and summa cum laude from the Baylor University School.
Well, all my folks said after I graduated was thank the laude. So, but thank
right.
you for that.
Well, good. And also executive editor of the University of Baylor University Law Review. So,
thank you. Long ago by this time, Joe. Long ago, but I appreciate the memories.
Wonderful accomplishments. So then you were a trial lawyer.
Yes.
And who did you practice with?
So I practiced with two different firms, first in Fort Worth with Shannon Gracie Ratliff and Miller. And then I went to the big city of Dallas, just got bigger and bigger, and was with Vinson and Elkins, which is an international law firm. But I got a phone call from a former Baylor Law School professor of mine asking whether I'd be interested in interviewing for a professor's job. It had never even crossed my mind. So be careful when you pick up the phone, because it can change your life, and mine did in the very best of ways as I became a Baylor Law School professor.
You were there for a number of years.
Yes, I was there for 16 years.
So what did you teach at Baylor?
So I have always taught from 1990 on to the present employment discrimination law. Employment law is my wheelhouse. I also teach a course at Campbell called workplace law, which is everything but discrimination law, including such things as overtime pay, non-compete clauses, and the like. And then my last area of teaching at Campbell is a course called Client Counseling, which is a course for third-year students. It kind of picks up the slack on what we may have neglected to teach them about relating to people, treating people as human beings with emotional needs, not just legal needs. It's a course I really love to teach.
Well, we're going to circle back to the employment law and to the workplace law courses and to your experience in that. The transition from Texas to North Carolina. Tell us a little bit about how you came to be a Tar Heel.
Well, it was another phone call, Joe. I got a phone call from the then provost of Baylor University, who also had been my interim pastor, so I knew him both professionally and personally. And he said that Dr. Jerry Wallace, president of Campbell University at the time, called and asked whether there was anyone on Baylor Law School's faculty who would make a good law school or great law school dean, he hoped, at Campbell, who was searching for a dean at that time. Again, I picked up the phone. I had never even visited North Carolina before that phone call. But I was intrigued by it because I'd heard of its beauty from coast to the mountains and everything in between. And I thought, well, I don't have a chance of getting this job, but maybe I'll get a free flight to North Carolina and get to see this beautiful state. And so one thing led to the other, and in 2006, my family and I picked up Lock, Stock, and Barrel, dog, two cars, and we traversed from Texas permanently to North Carolina, and we love it here.
We're so glad to have you. And you came to Campbell at a time of transition, is that right?
Definitely.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I really didn't know it was going to be a time of transition. The law school at that time was located where the main university is still located, in Buies Creek. And we began having problems about 6 weeks after I started as dean with one part of our building, the old Kivett Hall. To make a long story short, a lot of work was going to have to be done to Kivett Hall to make it habitable for the law school. And so that, in turn, started a feasibility study of whether the law school should be located in Raleigh, the state capital, which did not have a law school, and frankly, which was ripe for the picking. A lot of law schools were opening up at that time, or whether to stay on the main campus. And I became part of that discussion very quickly after I arrived, and very unexpectedly, frankly.
You made a wonderful and successful transition to Raleigh, very timely. You lost a few students when you were in Buies Creek to other places, but that's not going to happen anymore.
No, it's been a wonderful success, and even right now, we are looking at a very full class for this fall. We're very blessed to get great students, but also great people. I mean, I just love what I do. If it weren't for the students, I wouldn't do it. They're the best.
I use your library quite a bit.
And, wonderful.
They've always been very polite and also very assiduous-looking students.
So, yes, they work hard.
You get a good group
there. I'm glad to hear that, Joe.
Right on. So 6 years as dean, and then now you're back in the classroom.
Yes, I'm back in the classroom, picking up where I left off, really, when I became dean. 16 years of teaching, then transitioning to Campbell, essentially with the same courses, discrimination law and workplace law, but adding the client counseling course.
Tell us a little bit about the trajectory of legal education over the past couple of decades. You've got tremendous insight, I would think.
That is a loaded question, Joe. Tell me exactly what you want to know.
The nature of delivering the goods. In other words, when I was a law student, this is back in the 70s, the Socratic method was the method, or thought to be the method. And I tend to think that maybe you've gotten a little bit away from that.
I would say that Campbell probably is one of the few schools that hasn't gotten very far away from that.
Okay.
It's a very rigorous law school. We take the notion of producing lawyers who are going to competently and ethically represent their clients very, very seriously. So the first year, candidly, really is still based on the Socratic method of teaching. Now, in the second and third years, it's a blend, and it can vary depending on the type of the course. We have simulation courses, like trial advocacy, where you'll actually conduct direct examinations and so forth. And so courses differ, but that first year, we really call it brain training. That first year is all about training students' brain to analyze factual situations, to obviously learn the substantive law, and then to be able to apply the law to those facts and come to a conclusion or, as the case may be, alternative conclusion. So it's pretty deep that first year. It's a real challenge for my students.
And what drives lay people crazy, being able to argue both sides of the issue.
That's right.
It just blows people's minds.
It does.
That part of thinking like a lawyer.
You're exactly right. And as I said, alternative conclusions, because many times it's not just black or white. It could be black, gray, or white. And lawyers have to be skilled in the art of arguing their cases on behalf of their clients persuasively.
So, tradition. You've got tradition there at Campbell. Let me hark back to my law school days, and I will tell you that at my alma mater, we were well into the 70s at this point. We did not have a Title VII course. And the only labor and employment course we had, or they had to offer, was labor law,
right.
National Labor Relations Act. Now, there, I think there has been transition, hasn't there?
There's been a lot of transition there. In fact, I incorporate the National Labor Relations Act into workplace law, in part because, candidly, North Carolina is the least unionized state in the country at about 1.5% of our population. So it's just not an area of the law where there's a lot of need for practicing lawyers. It's a very niche area. That was not the case back, as you know, in the 70s when much more of our population nationwide was unionized. Back in the 50s and 60s, up to a third of the population were members of a union, and that has just slowly come down percentage-wise to where nationally I think it might be 7%, roughly thereabouts. So what we have seen, on the other hand, is a surge in employment discrimination lawsuits, mm-hmm. where although the act was passed in 1964, it really didn't gain traction in terms of there being a lot of litigation until, I would say, the 80s. Mm-hmm. And then workplace law, as I said, is the catch-all course where there are now so many state and federal laws regulating the workplace that are in addition to discrimination laws. So I have to teach that second course as well.
During the time that you've been a professor, perforce, you've been on the cutting edge of delivery of the content of labor and employment law to students in law schools.
Yes.
That has been an evolution, hasn't it?
It has been a challenge.
Okay.
One thing I can say is that being an employment law professor means that I'm continually learning. Mm-hmm. I'm continually researching cases, regulations, guidance, to know what the current state of the law is so that I can adequately teach my students, because employment law is a moving target, whether that's case law that's changing, whether that's courts interpreting statutes differently than they did before. It's a moving target, and it's also why I love it, because it's so interesting. It keeps me really, really intellectually engaged.
Never a dull moment.
Never a dull moment.
And I previously shared with you that we've covered a lot of ADA in this program.
Yes.
And FMLA and things of that nature. And, of course, the ADA came into effect in 1990 and the FMLA in 1993. So you had to do the initial courses on those.
Initially, it was just teaching the statute,
mm-hmm.
just the bare language of the statute. And, of course, as time has passed, now we've got many, many case decisions, many regulations, many guidances from the regulatory agencies that don't have the force of law, but try to give guidance to those whose rights might be impacted and also to employers.
ADA and Title I of the ADA. Tell me a little bit about what the trajectory of that has been.
Sure. So I will say that when I taught the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, initially it seemed to have some gravitas. Then we began to get a series of U.S. Supreme Court cases that really narrowed the definition of who was disabled. And if you're not disabled, you're not protected under the Act, so you don't ask any more questions because you're not protected. It's as though you're not male or female under the sex definition in Title VII. You're just not disabled. The then Democratic Congress in 2008 did not like those cases, and I call it the ADAAA, but in 2008, Congress passed significant changes to the definition of who was disabled, greatly expanding those who come under now the protection of the ADA. So it's a big change.
Has there been enough time, and it takes a lot of time for the law to evolve and to take shape. Have you got any impression of how the courts have taken to the sort of what was intended as an enlargement or bringing back the ADA to what it was supposed to be?
Most of the cases pre-2008 dealt with whether someone was disabled and protected under the Act or not, often or not. That largely has gone away because of the wide breadth of those who are disabled under the law. Mm-hmm. There are three different ways one can be disabled, either being actually disabled, regarded as disabled, or perceived as disabled. And what's happened in my reading of cases is more and more cases are dealing with not whether someone is disabled, but whether they're entitled to a reasonable accommodation by the employer.
I think what drives employers crazy, if the ADA were just a law that protected people with manifest disabilities, that would be one thing. But I think it is these sort of stealth disabilities that kind of come to the forefront after. I take it that that may be what the Congress was trying to protect with the amendment, 2008.
You know, it's hard to get inside Congress's head unless you look and find specific legislative history. The U.S. Supreme Court cases, let me give you one example. There was one Supreme Court case pre-2008 that said if you are using mitigating measures, for example, let's say you don't have a left leg, you're an amputee, but you have a prosthetic leg, you are to be considered disabled or not with that mitigating measure. In other words, someone without a leg might not be disabled, or back then, have been disabled under the Act. Really did not seem like the right result. That was Congress's strict reading of the statute as it existed at that time. That case has been specifically overruled, such that now you're to be considered disabled or not without those mitigating measures, without the prosthesis, without the insulin if you're diabetic and so on. But yes, I heard your question in terms of, because of the breadth of who is disabled, the burden that it absolutely places on employers. It does. There's no question.
So we've got the ADA. Of course, it is a regulation on the workplace, and it's leveling the playing field for people who have disabilities. We've also got the FMLA. Do you undertake any pedagogy on the FMLA at law school?
Yes. In fact, I have to teach the FMLA in both classes, employment discrimination law, as FMLA has, obviously, as its centerpiece, a leave provision that sometimes appends to an ADA reasonable accommodation leave. But then I very robustly teach the FMLA in the workplace law class because, my goodness, it's a workaday statute that impacts employers of 50 or more employees every day, whether someone is entitled to FMLA leave or not.
My perception of the ADA, it's a cascade of concepts. Every phrase has another defined phrase in it, but the FMLA is more nuts and bolts. I mean, it's a bunch of rules that, and you got to apply those rules.
I completely agree. Yeah. I completely agree.
So you've got the convergence of FMLA and ADA and trying to work all of those issues out as well.
That's, definitely. I'll tell listeners that what I tell my students, and that is, one of the best sources for understanding the law are the websites of the regulatory agencies over these two statutes. So, for example, the ADA is under EEOC.gov, which is the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission's website, EEOC.gov. There is a huge repository of very helpful information, both for employees and employers, to try to discern what their rights are under the ADA. Similarly, DOL.gov is where you'll find FMLA, the statute itself, as well as regulations. Both of them, frankly, are fairly tortuous in terms of understanding and untangling the rights and obligations that employers and employees have.
Does the Affordable Care Act work its way into your courses?
I have taught it a bit, but because it's fairly settled now, I really don't touch on it at this point.
Let me just say this. I know you more from your work in CLE, and Dean Esri has been a great resource for members of the practicing bar. In fact, I've brought a couple of seminar books that you were imported in, the North and South Carolina Labor and Employment Lawyer Seminar this past fall, and then the North Carolina Labor and Employment Section Seminar.
Thank you.
And you've teamed up with Laura Wetch,
who
has also been a guest on this program.
Oh, wonderful.
And she did not speak about the topic that you all were talking about,
right,
which was the public policy exception, but you give a very good talk about that. Will you fill the listeners in a little bit on public policy exception?
Sure. There is a very compelling story that led to the creation of what's called a tort, a cause of action if you're wrongfully discharged against public policy. Here are the facts of the case of Duke versus Sides. A nurse told a doctor not to give this specific anesthesia to a patient because it was against her best judgment. He did so regardless, and the patient was permanently brain damaged. He committed medical malpractice. She was asked by members of Duke not to tell the truth when her deposition was taken when the family filed the lawsuit. She told the truth. She told what had happened with her advice to the doctor, which he ignored. And in return for doing so, she ultimately was terminated by Duke. Well, when you look at discrimination statute, she wasn't in a protected class. So Title VII, Employment Discrimination Statute, didn't help her at all. So you had to look around. Well, what was there? Because her termination really was against public policy of wanting people to tell the truth under oath and not committing perjury. And ultimately, our North Carolina Supreme Court created a very narrow exception to what is a general principle, and that is you can be fired for any reason as long as it's not an illegal reason, the at-will doctrine. And that particular exception is you can't fire someone if it's against North Carolina public policy, as that public policy is expressed in our statutes and the North Carolina Constitution. It's a narrow exception, but wow, if it applies, is it powerful?
Of course, I was in private practice myself at the time that change came about. What a huge watershed event that was. There was a point in time, I think, where rights of employees seemed to be expanding, that the universe seemed to be expanding. And the Sides case was an example. The ADA is an example. FMLA, big changes in workers' comp, which I still do quite a bit of. Do you see a different trajectory now? For example, I've been in the news that employers can now get employees to sign away their rights to class action. Do you think that that is a part of a trend, or is that a one-off event?
I don't have a crystal ball. I will say that arbitration clauses are an example of employees losing power.
Mm-hmm.
Because an arbitration clause is a contract between the employer and the employee, and according to our court system, employers can demand employees sign arbitration agreements that cover any dispute, whether it exists then or in the future, and not have the right to go to a jury trial.
Mm-hmm.
That fundamentally offends me, frankly. Mm-hmm. We see it in the consumer area as well. And it absolutely eviscerates the right of persons to aggregate together and form a class action. So independently, a claim might not be worth much money, but aggregating it together in a class action, filing a lawsuit in court, oftentimes gives voice to offenses that have occurred that may be small, but when aggregated, the employer simply needs to stop them and sometimes pay damages. Arbitration clauses essentially eviscerate and take away the right to have a class action, which means, candidly, those claims are never brought. It's a disturbing trend. Is it isolated? I would say no. When you look at unemployment insurance in North Carolina, we now are 50th among the 50 states in terms of the amount of money one can get for unemployment and the duration one can get it. We are last on the list. Mm-hmm. That is not much of a safety net when someone loses a job. It's not much of a safety net at all. And our North Carolina legislature has made a concerted decision not to expand that, even though we've paid back the federal government what we owed them, and now we have over $1 billion reserve. But that's not employee friendly, and I just have to state it as it is. Do employers have many, many obligations that drive them crazy, like the ADA? Yes. Like FEMLA? Yes. So I can't say that it's a level playing field one way or the other. It really depends on the subject. We do have these executive agencies like the Department of Labor, like the EEOC, which are comprised of presidentially appointed commissioners, and the president in power has the right for the majority seats to appoint any vacancies. And right now, the EEOC, for example, we have two democratically more employee-minded commissioners and one interim chair appointed by President Trump and two vacancies, which President Trump has the right to appoint. And you would begin, I would assume, to see more conservative guidance, more employer-friendly types of regulations and guidance coming from what will be the newly constituted EEOC.
Thank you, Dean Esri. We are running out of time. Thank you again for joining us and being a wonderful guest. And tell our listeners to tune in on the fourth Tuesday of every month at 2 p.m. for Legal Matters. We rebroadcast the following Wednesday at 7 a.m. We hope you've enjoyed the show today and discovered information about your legal rights. I'm Joe Austin, and thanking once again Dean Melissa Esri from the Campbell University School of Law. We want you to come back, Dean Esri.
Thank you, Joe. I'd love to. You can tell I can talk a lot.
You are a great guest.
Thank you.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. After it's broadcast, you can readily find it as a podcast at our website, www.trianglereadingservice.org. www.trianglereadingservice.org, where you'll be able to listen to it again and share it with others. If you have any comments or questions from today's episode or wish to share a topic that you want us to explore, please call us at 919-832-5138, 919-832-5138, and you can reach us via email at info@trrsnc.org.